And we are back with another episode of the Kyle Anzalone Show. And I am very excited today to be welcoming Professor Glenn Deason back to the show. Sir, how are you doing today?
Very good. It's good to see you again.
Absolutely. There's so much happening in the world right now. A lot I want to get your thoughts on as a real geopolitical analyst. So no peace talks, apparently. The Lebanon ceasefire was announced today. Trump's blockade, and how is that going? And what's next for Ukraine and NATO? So starting off here, we got this report today from Reuters that Iran has informed them that the U.S. and Iran are no longer looking at or working on a comprehensive peace deal to actually end the conflict, but rather are just discussing a short-term ceasefire extension, potentially 2 weeks. We also got a report from Bloomberg that they spoke with European and Arab officials who said they assess that a peace deal is going to take at least 6 months to hammer out. So, Professor Deason, what are your kind of short-term thoughts on negotiations between the U.S. and Iran? Is there anything serious here? Are we just taking a short pause in this war before ramping up back to major conflict?
Well, I think it can still go both ways, but I don't think there was that much hope to begin with on this ceasefire. I think overall, Trump got into a war, which he thought would be a quick fix. And if it wouldn't work, at least he could do as he did during the 12-day war, just drop a few bombs on some critical infrastructure and claim victory and go home. I think where everything went south was when Iran seized the Strait of Hormuz. This is really something that prevents Trumps from going home and declaring victory, because it allows essentially Iran to assert its deterrence. This is how it can get its reparations. It can pressure countries in the region to expel the U.S. bases. It can do many things. So for this reason, it essentially became a long war, and the U.S. has some problems, economic as well as the military capacity to fight such a intensity war over a long period of time. So I think it was in the interest of Trump to try to put an end to this war, but the terms put forward by the Iranians, outlined in their 10-point plan, it's seen as too much of a defeat for the U.S., a defeat that they would be able to absorb. So for this reason, I think they just agreed to the 10-point plan as a ceasefire, as a point of departure, and then essentially ignored the whole thing. Just looking to drag it out, I think, because there's no good solution to this, effectively.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons I'm concerned they declare this ceasefire and dragging it out is just to revamp and, kind of reload and get ready. And that's what Pete Hegseth said today. So let's play this clip of the American Secretary of War.
We are reloading with more power than ever before, and better intelligence. Even more importantly, better intelligence than ever before, as you expose yourself with your movement to our watchful eye. We are locked and loaded on your critical dual-use infrastructure, on your remaining power generation, and on your energy industry. We'd rather not have to do it, but we're ready to go at the command of our president and at the push of a button.
So, Professor Deason, the USS George H.W. Bush is on its way to the Middle East. The Boxer Amphibious Ready Group, which is about 4,000 soldiers, including the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit, they're on their way to the Middle East. They're both expected to arrive, I think, the last week of the month of April. Are we seeing the U.S. and Israel doing the same thing they've done in the past, where this is really not serious negotiations? It's more about time to position military units where they think they need to be in order to restart this war.
Well, I think so. But that being said, it could be interpreted in two ways. One would be that it can be used as leverage in negotiations, that is to have a big potential punching power as an incentive for Iran to accept whatever deal the U.S. puts in front of it. Or alternatively, and I think more likely, it's simply using a temporary ceasefire to rearm. And we are seeing the buildup of weapons in the region. Also, usually when you're in a ceasefire, you wouldn't escalate by imposing a blockade on Iranian ports. This is not how ceasefire is supposed to work. That's an act of war. And I think that it's most likely that this is just the ceasefire was just to regroup, rearm, and get some breathing space and continue the war. Because even if this is for pressuring Iran, the problem is that what the U.S. wants from Iran, it can't achieve, it can't get, because the U.S. final objective is essentially regime change and I would say balkanization of Iran. And all this, I guess, stepping stone towards that goal are therefore unacceptable. So, for example, putting cuts in its ballistic missiles or reducing the amount of drones or severing partnerships with allies in the regions, all of this would weaken Iran's ability to defend itself, essentially why the U.S. is having trouble now. So the idea that this would be the foundation of a peace agreement for Iran to capitulate and without a conventional deterrent, base its security on the good nature of Israel and the United States, it's not how states behave. So I think whatever the objective is with all of this, the likely outcome is more war.
And I want to ask, you say this isn't how states behave. I completely agree with you on that. So if the U.S. does go back to war with Iran, it will be seen as the third time in a year that the U.S. and Israel use the cover of diplomacy and negotiations in order to set the stage for a military attack on a country. And as we now know, Trump had decided to attack Iran in early February. So those negotiations were all a masquerade, all showed to give the U.S. time to build up military forces in the Middle East. Do other countries around this world, and particularly adversaries, Russia, China, North Korea, look at this pattern of U.S. diplomat behavior and have to readjust the way that they do business or negotiations at all with the U.S. because you can't trust the United States in any negotiations whatsoever, apparently?
No, and I think especially a good case would be Russia, because with the war in Ukraine, keep in mind that initially, it was the U.S. that rejected any ceasefire. I remember Blinken was very specific that this is not acceptable. But now that Ukraine is doing very poorly and they're struggling, the Western countries and especially the Europeans are calling for a ceasefire. And the Russians have made it clear that the ceasefire is not peace. It's the opposite of peace, because it's not an effort to resolve the underlying problems. It's just to give some breathing space, have time to regroup, rearm, and then fight from a more favorable position. So for this reason, this is why, as we remember, when Putin and Trump went to Alaska, they essentially agreed there would be no ceasefire. There would be a peace agreement, which actually resolves the conflict. And then suddenly Trump reverted again and started repeating what the Europeans said. Oh, we need an immediate ceasefire, unconditional. But this won't do anything to fix the war. It's just meant to prolong it. So I think that, the Russians saw this already before, but I think that this kind of confirms their suspicions. So, and it also makes it very clear why they wouldn't accept something like this. But overall, it is problematic, because if you don't have trust in agreements, it's very difficult to make any peace. Diplomacy doesn't work anymore. So the way Trump is using diplomacy, agreements as some kind of a currency to make the adversary lower their guards so they can attack, I mean, this will have a lot of long-term effects, which are very unfortunate for the United States as well.
Absolutely. Now, we did get some big news today regarding Lebanon. One of the main issues with the ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran is that it was supposed to cover, and the Pakistanis who brokered it said so, all the warring parties in the Middle East. And so that would have been Hezbollah in Lebanon. But Israel has actually ramped up its attacks on Lebanon since the announcement of the ceasefire. Now, President Donald Trump says, I think right about now, actually, 5 p.m. Eastern time, so 3 minutes from now, they're supposed to be be a full ceasefire going on in Lebanon. Now, this was negotiated between Tel Aviv, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Israeli president. And it's important to note that Hezbollah is a non-state military, so they don't operate under the orders of Beirut. Professor Deason, do you see this as maybe a signal that we are actually moving to an end of this conflict, or is this just more of a show to buy time for the ceasefire?
Quality proteins aren't just for special occasions. With Omaha Steaks, you get mouth-watering proteins delivered right to your door, individually packaged and portioned, so a great dinner is just minutes away. From Taco Tuesday to a weekend feast, taste the Omaha Steaks difference. Start getting flavorful proteins delivered today. Visit omahasteaks.com and get $35 off with promo code AUDIO at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code AUDIO. Terms apply. See site for details.
Well, they had a ceasefire in Gaza as well, which was supposed to end the genocide. And after the ceasefire, they still continue to kill. So it's I have a hard time believing that it's going to last. But I heard Netanyahu also make some comments that they would like to find a way of working with the Lebanese government to collectively purge and disarm Hezbollah. If they can make the Lebanese fight among themselves, it might be favorable as opposed to Israel going in. So I'm doubtful that this will last. But yeah, you mentioned that Israel had pounded Lebanon pretty hard, and I think that's a great point, because it is interesting that the largest attack they had on Lebanon in terms of having a lot of bombing of Beirut, the biggest campaign began on the first day of the ceasefire. Now, whether or not that ceasefire covered Lebanon, which it did, but even if it didn't, one would have to ask the question, why? Why do this on the first day, this kind of brutal attack? So it looks as if it was an effort to derail the entire negotiations to begin with.
Absolutely, because it seems pretty clear that the position it puts Iran in is either they're hanging their ally Hezbollah out to dry, who only, you know, Israel was already bombing Lebanon over the past year, even though there was a ceasefire, but they really were bombing at a much slower pace, and Hezbollah wasn't firing rockets at Israel until Israel assassinated the Iranian supreme leader, in which point Hezbollah said, okay, that's such a provocation, we're going to enter the fight against Israel. So either Iran has to say to Hezbollah, like, we know you entered this war on our behalf, but now we're going to let Israel take their greater loss in the Middle East out on southern Lebanon, or we're going to attack Israel. I mean, you know, it seems Benjamin Netanyahu tries to play this game a lot with President Donald Trump. After Operation Midnight Hammer in the summer, Donald Trump brokers the ceasefire with Iran, and then Israel goes and tries to carry out a major attack on the country. Donald Trump publicly said that he had to tell the Israeli fighter jets to turn back. So do you see Donald Trump, the White House, standing up to Benjamin Netanyahu enough to actually end this conflict?
Well, I guess, again, this can also be seen in two ways. One is that the Israelis are essentially running Washington now, and Trump is trying to push back. Alternatively, this is them essentially just playing good cop, bad cop, I guess. But I suspect that it's more along the line of the former. That is, that Israel has quite extensive and intrusive influence over Washington, and especially with Trump, as we've seen, the Israeli influence networks are quite strong. And there seems to be plenty of evidence suggesting that Israel had a lot to do with getting Trump into this war as well, in terms of selling it as a more or less a quick fix. Just regarding the ceasefire, it could be a way of trying to manage or acquire more escalation control. Because what has stood really out in this war is how Iran, in order to deter its adversaries, essentially denies U.S. escalation dominance, that is, the ability to escalate and escalate until the adversary will have to capitulate or stand down. And Iran has essentially showed it can go up that escalation ladder with the United States. And indeed, Iran can do many things that the U.S. can't do. For example, the U.S. can destroy Iranian desalination plants, but you know they have other source of water. If the Iranians retaliate against desalination plants in the Gulf states, they just return back to being deserts, essentially. And across the board, you find different ways where Iran actually has advantage. So maybe this is a part of the purpose of the ceasefire, is to de-escalate when necessary and then escalate on the conditions that are favorable to the United States and Israel.
I do worry that that is the case. And I mean, you know, we see it with the United States all over the world. Another example would be like Ukraine. After the U.S. did the coup there and Russia seizes the Crimean Peninsula, civil war breaks out. We broker the Minsk 1 and 2 agreements for a ceasefire. But the West has been pretty transparent since that that was all just a charade, a pause in order to give time to equip the Ukrainian military and prepare them for war with Russia, which they ultimately ended up provoking. And now, one thing that does seem different, and one of Netanyahu's main arguments that seems to have done something to convince Donald Trump to attack Iran now, is that Iran could produce missiles faster and far cheaper than the U.S. and Israel could produce interceptors. And so it's not as if the ratios here get better over time, where if, you know, we put this on the shelf for a few years, sure, Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz, then we could go back to war with Iran. Well, by that time, Iran's going to have made money controlling the Strait of Hormuz, but also produce 10 times more missiles than we produce interceptors. So if they do try to put this on the shelf to give time, is there, do you see any prospects where 2, 3, 5, 10 years down the line, the U.S. and Israel would have a better opportunity to take a shot at Iran?
No, it looks like this would likely be the best opportunity because otherwise Iran can strengthen itself again. And I think this is how the Israelis see it as well. That is, it's kind of the last chance to knock out Iran, because the overarching trends in the international system is that the U.S. global hegemony is in decline. That means it will be less influence in the region. There will be other actors having greater influence. And also for Israel, which has, for the past decades, not had to make any compromises, it would have to begin to, make peace with neighbors if it sees that the U.S. is weakening, or it can go for this full victory now by trying to take out Iran. So I think 10 years down the future, it's simply too much uncertainty. But I think, you pointed out very well part of the problem of this war. And this is, the United States have a lot of good advanced weapons, but the interceptive missiles it has, they're expensive and they're in short supply, especially after fighting this proxy war against Russia. So what we see is essentially drones from Iran costing a few thousand dollars, which the U.S. has to spend and intercepting missiles to stop, which cost a few million dollars. So this doesn't really work. And in the long run, Iran can exhaust the United States. And from this perspective, I think time might be on Iran's side, which is why I think Trump would want a quick end to this, or at least put it on the slow burner.
Absolutely. I do want to turn our attention to the U.S. blockade of the Iranian-controlled Strait of Hormuz. This is U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, apparently Trump's favorite general, General Raisin Kane, and this is what he had to say earlier today.
Let me be clear. This blockade applies to all ships, regardless of nationality, heading into or from Iranian ports. The U.S. action is a blockade of Iran's ports and coastline, not a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Enforcement will occur inside Iran's territorial seas and in international waters. In addition to this blockade, the joint force, through operations and activities in other areas of responsibility, like the Pacific area of responsibility under the command of Admiral Paparo, will actively pursue any Iranian-flagged vessel or any vessel attempting to provide material support to Iran.
Well, I mean, I know the whole statement is completely insane, the idea that the U.S. military is going to operate in Iranian territorial waters. But the major threat, the one that I see as very problematic, is saying that we're going to intercept any country flagged ship that leaves an Iranian port, which would mean Chinese or other East Asian nations. Do you think the U.S. military is really prepared to board, stop an Iranian, a Chinese-flagged oil tanker that left an Iranian port?
Well, it remains to be seen. This is, historically, this is the control over transportation corridors. It has been a key component of wars. But when he argues that, you know, we're going to stop all vessels irrespective of what country they come from, yes, but the overwhelming majority of all Iranian oil is sold to China. So it's primarily China which are being cut off. Scott Bessent made this very clear as well, that the Chinese will now be stopped from buying Iranian oil. And you also have an American senator, I forgot what his name was, but he was also making the point that if a consequence of this is that there's a bit of a crack in the Chinese economy, well, that would make him very happy. So it's not as if the Chinese do not know that they are also a target in this war. And we can imagine how it would be if the shoe was on the other side, if the Chinese were putting up a blockade, stopping and boarding American tankers. This is not legal in any way, and it's an act of aggression. The fact that they won't only do it against Iran, but also do it against friendly countries like India, it's gonna have a lot of consequences. So we don't know yet what they're gonna be, but that's just that dimension. It's also, as you alluded to, the extent to which this can actually be achieved. I mean, they have to stay pretty far away from the Iranian coastline, and it's very hard to, with this distance, it widens out. It's very difficult to actually patrol this region. You need a lot of naval assets in the region. They have to be maintained, replenished, and there's not that many safe ports either. So a lot of this creates a bit of a challenge. And I'm not sure how well they planned in advance for this, or if they're just, trying to put something together last minute.
Yeah, I do worry that this is once again maybe a situation where Donald Trump looked at what happened with Venezuela, where the U.S. was able to seize all those oil tankers. Although, as you mentioned, the geography of the Caribbean is far different than the geography of, I guess that would be the Arabian Gulf there as you exit the Strait of Hormuz. And then you're on into the Indian Ocean. If you had to stay far away from Iran's coastline, those ships have a lot of room to maneuver. Also worth noting that some of those ships that left the Caribbean, one made it all the way to the North Atlantic. I think two actually made it to the Indian Ocean. And so it's not as if we just intercepted all those ships immediately after we targeted them. We knew where they were right away and were able to do that. These are actually complex operations that aren't as simple to pull off as somebody who just watched the CENTCOM clips, which probably includes President Donald Trump, leads them to believe. And the potential international crisis with China here is huge. Now, Professor Deason, before I let you go, I do want to turn the attention to the U.S. relationship with Ukraine, or not Ukraine, but also NATO more generally. In the past few weeks, we've heard Donald Trump waffle between, he sounds like a spurred lover, right? Where he goes between, I don't need you. Actually, I really want you involved in this operation. So how are the Europeans kind of reacting and trying to manage the relationship with Donald Trump as he obviously tries to drive them into this conflict? And he is a very irrational actor, as we see.
Well, I think overall the relationship is becoming obviously more and more strained. As you said, he's gone a bit back and forth. I've always been convinced that if Trump would have invited the Europeans to participate in this, then they might have taken a bigger role. But the thing is, he didn't invite them, and he didn't even tell them. And the Europeans were first invited after the war was beginning to go south. And I think this is a key problem, because now, nobody wants to join a failed military operation or a war. So the Europeans are taking some distance. Even key or important people who aligned themselves closely with Trump, like The Prime Minister of Italy, even she is now taking a very harsh tone against Trump. So there's a lot of divisions there. Not only does Trump want the Europeans to take a greater role or even outsource this problem to the Europeans, but he also blames now the Europeans essentially can be a scapegoat for why this war is going poorly. And I guess, yeah, a key victim would be NATO, but I don't. But that might be a plus for Trump because he already has some grievances with NATO, and again, it could be an opportunity for the United States to begin to decouple a bit from Europe as well. But overall, I think the Europeans, they still hope that there's an opportunity to rebuild relations with the United States and keep NATO alive. At the same time, they also have to adjust to reality. And and of course, the Trump's position towards Ukraine is also something that's troubling many of them, because it was initially the U.S. that helped to convince a lot of the Europeans to join in on this proxy war against Russia back in 2022. And now, essentially, Trump is washing his hands with it, saying, well, it was a European war. We helped you. You should be grateful. You didn't help us, so now we're going to leave. I mean, this was also an American war. It's that's not to excuse what the Europeans have been doing. I mean, they've been more hawkish than the United States, in many regards more irrational as well, in terms of refusing to recognize realities on the ground in Ukraine. But of course, the way this is being spun as, you know, not America's war, it's not accurate.
Absolutely. And I do want to ask you about the impacts that the Iran conflict is going to have on the war in Ukraine. I have this clip from Friedrich Merz, the German chancellor, that I thought was pretty interesting.
We'll be coordinating closely when it comes to Ukrainian citizens who have sought refuge in our country, and will make it easier for them to return home. The efforts of the number of Ukrainian men who take refuge here is something we'll be working with Ukraine to limit, because it is crucial that these men are there to help their country.
So I thought this was interesting, because this is something that I've read about for about 3 years now, that Ukraine is trying to get some of their young men who went to another country after the Russian invasion to come back so they could conscript them and put them in the army. The fact that Germany is now bending to this, I would think, suggests that Ukraine's manpower shortage is getting more intense, and Zelensky is basically coming to Merz begging to do this because they need more forces. So I do wonder how much of an impact the war in the Middle East is having on Ukraine, and that's maybe part of the reason that Zelensky is now in such dire straits.
Well, one of the problems for Ukraine has been the manpower problem. That is, they have a huge shortage, and for this reason, a lot of their men fled, many to Russia, and many went westwards towards Europe. And a solution to this is if the Europeans begin to deport the Ukrainian refugees, so Zelensky can send them to the trenches. And people like Merz, I think, will be very happy to do this. Because then they're less of an economic drain in Germany, and they get to feed the war machine in Ukraine. This has, by the way, been a very consistent theme. Every time we hear politicians speak about standing with Ukraine, being pro-Ukrainian, you know, this is what it often entails: toppling the government, reversing election results, sabotaging peace agreements, ignoring or boycotting diplomacy. And now, of course, deporting Ukrainian refugees to fill up the trenches again. So it's, this is a war to the last Ukrainians. This is why, the Istanbul agreements were sabotaged by the US and UK in the beginning of 2022. Because if you spend a decade to build up, or at least 8 years building up a huge proxy army, you don't want a peace agreement where Ukraine becomes neutral. You want to use your proxy army. So, and that's what they want to get their money's worth. And I think, it's a great shame. This was not their war either. This was a war provoked by NATO, which would then provoke the was started by NATO, I would say, by toppling the government and then provoking a Russian invasion. And now, you know, many of the men fled and now they're going to be deported. But sorry, Bob, back to your question, though, about how the Iran war will impact this. I think, obviously, Russia's flushed with cash at the moment because the oil prices have been so high. It's been more difficult to uphold sanctions on Russia. Meanwhile, the Europeans, who were previously cut themselves off from Russian energy and Russian fertilizers, as well as Belarusian, well, now they're being forced cut off from the Middle Eastern ones as well. So they're put in a very, very vulnerable position. So Russia has seized an advantage. The Europeans and Americans have less money to send now, but also less weapons because so much has gone to the Middle East. So overall, I think desperation is starting to set in. And all of this is happening at a time when the Russians are now launching their spring offensive in a big way. And also the Russians are taking a page out of the Iranian book because the Iranians didn't shy away from retaliating. They went up that escalation ladder. And now they have a powerful deterrent. Russia did the opposite. They let essentially everything slide. And now you have NATO countries launching missiles with their own contractors into Russian cities. You have European governments bragging about the hundreds of thousands of drones they're making and sending to Ukraine to fight Russia. So there's no deterrence anymore. So now I think the Russians are also stepping up their rhetoric and suggesting that they might start to target these drone factories in Europe. So I think overall, I think a lot will change over the next few months.
Absolutely. Professor Deason, thank you so much for your time and analysis on my show today. Everybody, be sure you like, share, and subscribe to the show. And Professor Deason, we'll have to do it again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.